You are listening to the Valeo Mentis podcast.
On this episode, you'll meet Dr. Sarah Roos, the AAEP president-elect and an equine technical manager. We discuss her diverse educational and practicing background, advice for vets looking for mentorship, becoming AAEP's president-elect, the purpose and functions of AAEP, the state of the industry, and much more.
Here on Valeo Mentis, the goal is to shrink the veterinary world by connecting people together through stories and helpful resources. So listen closely and enjoy.
How are you, Dr. Roos?
Well, John, how are you?
Good. It's good to see you again. So my new thing is now my cell phone, when I call somebody, it doesn't ring on my end. And I have no idea why. Hmm. And I know it's some setting. And because I'm not like, you know, I don't have a ponytail and I don't drink coffee at Starbucks all day, I don't know how to change it.
So. You know what we were joking about yesterday is, do you remember, like, we used to pay extra money for like specialized ringtones?
Yeah.
And now I couldn't tell you the last time my phone has rang because I've had it on like vibrate silence for the last year.
Next tells were the funniest because we were all on walkie-talkies speaker in the grocery store.
I have one of those because of you and Dan. Ryan and I grew up together. I'm sure you know this, Dr. Roos, but I got made fun of so bad at my first job because I wore that thing on my belt with like a tape measure.
That we all did.
Well, thanks for being on with us, Dr. Roos.
Sure. Is the sound okay?
Yeah, sounds good.
I feel like this is what I did. I did the AAP podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I think it all came through fine.
Yeah.
Well, we're a garage band, so we're not as fancy. Let's get going here. Obviously, you're the president-elect of the AAP, but we're not going to start there. I'd like to start out with, what's a typical day when you're not working?
What's a day that I'm not working? I'm unfamiliar with that concept.
Okay, so let's say you didn't have any responsibilities, and you were fired from your job, and what would you be doing?
Oh, what would I would be spending time with my perfect unicorn Chili. Poor Ryan has had to listen to me talk about my horse Bunny, and he sees pictures of him Bunny. So I am the worst horse owner, like the worst adult amateur horse owner on the face of the planet in terms of being pathologically obsessed, I think is a fair statement, with my horse.
Oh, well, that's good though, because it's usually always the veterinarian's horses that are the worst off. Like, it's always the doctor's kids that are sick.
But it sounds like...
So, full disclosure, like, I do a little bit of his veterinary care, but I don't do all of it, but my good friends at Littleton Equine are my veterinarians, my horse, and like, they're equally scared to work on him because in general, like, it is the horse of a veterinarian that whatever bad, weird complication that no one has ever heard of generally happens to, you know, the animals owned by a veterinarian. So
Right. We're
all careful with what we do with him. But so
far, that's good. When did you move to Colorado?
I've been here 5 years now.
Oh, wow. Yep.
I get around.
No, it's a great place. So you live outside of Denver somewhere, I'm assuming?
Yeah, we're in Littleton for 10 minutes from Littleton Equine.
Oh, good. That's cool.
Good spot to be, you know, if you have a horse and need veterinary care.
Agreed. Comes in handy.
Good friends to hang out with. Certainly, you know, from an AAP leadership standpoint, it is very beneficial to have three past AAP presidents that live in my backyard that can be my own informal advisory council as well. So there's a lot of benefits.
Is that written in the bylaws?
It is not, but as soon as I got the nod, there was a call to those three fine gentlemen. But hey, can I pick your brains from time to time for, you know, a cup of coffee or dinner, or whatever you would like, so that I can benefit from the experience of those fine gentlemen?
Yeah, we had a guest on, and he had done an internship at Littleton and had some wild stories about, like, working with Dr. Beeman's dad, like that far back.
Yep.
And it's awesome. And we're like, man, we'd love to get Dr. Beeman on here sometime.
Oh, you should.
Yeah.
Block out a lot of time. The man has some amazing stories.
I agree.
Amazing stories.
Yeah.
Well, I asked him once, this was like last year, the year before, I was at Littleton doing intern rounds, you know, shortly before AP convention. So just kind of asking like, who all coming to convention? And I said to Dr. Beeman, I was like, Dr. Beeman, when is the last time you were not at AAP convention? He's like, 1960. He's like, and I know that because my daughter was born December, whatever, of that year. And, you know, my wife told me if I went to convention and missed her birth, that, you know, we would be divorced and we're still married.
Yep. And it's amazing. I bet it sticks with him because he's like, only ever missed one. You know?
Yeah. His institutional knowledge is amazing. You should definitely get him on as a guest.
Yeah, we're going to try pretty hard and yeah, we'll see. So we'll probably have to get a little bit of technical help like on that end. So maybe you want to help us with that. I don't know, but
I feel like he would be pretty easy because I know like when Jessica Dunbar records the AP Practice Life podcast, sometimes like she just does it in the clinic. So I'm sure she could even like.
Oh, yeah.
Be the handler.
She probably has everything already set up there. Yeah. Oh, that'd be cool. Yeah. Yeah, are you excited about like AAP being right in your backyard this year too? Like that's pretty
cool. Where she's planning it.
It is. It is in a weird, convenient-ish twist of fate. Like so, kind of the way AAP leadership works is your president-elect year, you're the program chair for convention, and it just so happens that I am the program chair for convention when it is in Denver.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it is kind of convenient that way.
Good luck. Some things got to go right sometimes, you know?
You know, it is nice. Like, I don't have to factor, like, travel stress into all of the stress that I will have from convention. Mm. Like, there won't be, you know, plane delay. I miss a meeting. They lose my luggage, whatever. It will literally be pretty much probably, like, my whole closet will get packed into my car and drive to the convention center, unload my closet. So my wardrobe should be on point because I don't even have to think about what I'm going to pack.
Mm-hmm. People are like, are you moving? No, I'm going to a convention.
Don't want to have to worry about not having the pair of shoes that I want. So
nice.
It'll be in my time zone. You know, so many winning things.
Yep.
So sure. So as many horse owners do, they leave out their like significant others that's not a equine companion. So tell me about your significant other.
Yes. So my significant other also is familiar with the equine pharmaceutical industry. So my soon to be husband, I guess I can still call him my fiance, was a equine sales rep for close to 30 years. So Sloan Harrison, for anyone who wants me to name drop him. So it's the good and the bad, right? Like I feel like so many of us in the equine industry are married to other people in the equine industry, which is good and bad, right? Like, yeah, it's the good of like they can empathize with our day-to-day struggles and like understand the horse obsession and all those sorts of things. It makes it hard sometimes to have conversations that don't just involve work and horses and talking about other things as well. So it's, you know, the balance of the two.
Yeah. Dang, I didn't know that. That's amazing. And I'm a huge fan. And you know, I tell Sloan, I said hi.
So that is why I live in Littleton.
Ah, so this is, yes, this makes
sense. Intrigue.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know. You guys edit this podcast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't worry.
It's the good of the entertaining stories of, you know, like how one comes to be in one's various place. But yes, that is why I now live in Colorado is because Sloan and I started dating. Yeah. You know, there was my job got classified as remote thanks to, you know, again, there was a lot of bad things about COVID, but there were some good things. Mm-hmm. So when I got officially reclassified as remote and did not have to report to the home office, then it became possible for me to move here. And here we are.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think
you don't have to edit that out. I don't care. I'm a pretty open book about my life.
Yeah. Either you worked at Littleton or you know John Ryan, like if you're in the industry, that's kind of how it goes.
You know, I always joke and I always tell vet students this, like, or anyone really, like, it is at most 2 degrees of separation in the equine veterinary industry. If you try hard enough, it is probably 1 degree of separation. And I think especially like if there's a couple of like key kind of like touch points in your life, like that drastically does shrink that separation. I think for me, a lot of it is like having done my residency at Texas A&M, like like the A&M network definitely shrinks your bubble. I think the Littleton network shrinks your bubble. Mm-hmm. Being an industry, obviously, like we are, our bubble is so huge in terms of all of the different touch points that we have that it is pretty easy to draw a direct line between.
I think that's
one of the things that makes it a magical industry to be involved with.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I totally agree. It's what makes it, right? Like, right.
It's like a big
But thing. It is why I always tell the students that is don't burn bridges. Like if you treat one person badly, that could follow you.
Yeah. Reputation is follows closely. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Now I'm going to be real embarrassed if I get this wrong, but did you do undergrad at Penn State? Is it my memory?
We, did. Yes. We are.
All right. We are.
Penn Let's State. Go on a tangent. Let's do it. Let's talk about the meat labs. Let's go.
Oh, the meat labs and the creamery. Oh, how I miss the creamery.
Me too. What year did you graduate?
God, you can make me tell my age.
Century.
Undergrad in 2001.
2001. Okay. Yeah. I graduated in 2004. Yeah. Yeah. So I just missed you.
It was a lovely, lovely place.
I agree.
Those were good years too.
They were. They were. I still have very fond memories of my time there and happy that it has, gotten me to where I am.
Right. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
I do like the random, again, like, because there are a good number of Penn State grads, again, between industry, obviously, as veterinarians. And,
Stacey Cordovano, she was a classmate.
Uh-huh. Ernie Martinez.
Yeah. I don't know anybody else. Either you and Stacey.
We have a few other sales reps that are Penn State grads. I think there's a few other ones. I can't think of other veterinarians. I have a couple of friends that sadly are not in equine anymore. I think they all went small.
Oh, yeah. We should probably talk about that, too, eventually.
We can. It happened.
Right.
So,
I grew up in Pennsylvania. So
where did you grow up?
So I grew up actually like 10 minutes from New Bolton. So I grew up in Chester County, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But I always feel the need to make the disclaimer that I grew up in a very horsey area, but to parents that not only knew nothing about horses, were arguably quite terrified of horses. So like I did not get the horse gene necessarily, by birth or even where I grew up. The flip side of that being I was very fortunate that I grew up in a super horsey area. So when I kind of incidentally got the horse gene, like this was the time where we were latchkey kids, right? Like I got off the school bus, both of my parents were at work. There was a Hunter Jumper barn about a mile up the road. So I would get off the school bus, dump my backpack in the house and walk to the barn every day where I just inserted myself, cleaning stalls, cleaning tack, flipping horses, doing whatever I could do to essentially, pay for lessons and kind of that's how I got into the horse world that way. And again, was just lucky that it was such a horse area that it's really kind of only in hindsight that I appreciate, like Devon Horse Show was right there. Radnor Hunt was right there. Like I got early exposure to some really cool aspects of the horse industry just by nature of where I grew up.
Amazing. The world's best after school program right there.
It really, and it's funny because then again, I don't have kids now, so I'm not judging parenting techniques of today, but I feel like I don't know now how many people would just like let their kid, and it wasn't a super busy road, but like there was traffic on the road. And I was probably from about the time I was 12 onwards, it was just to the barn.
Yep. Yep. Your parents knew you could handle. They were like, she can handle herself.
Yeah. And then, it depended. A lot of times, like my mom might come get me, at the end of the evening because it might be dark by then. But if not, I would back home.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great way to grow up. And then summer's the same. Like, summer break, wake up in the morning, walk to the barn, work at the barn all day and come home whenever I was done, sunburned and happy.
Yep.
There's a funny, not funny story, but my dad tells that my mom was working on the farm and we when we were little, my sister was a toddler and she walked like 200 yards to the road before my mom noticed. So that kind of tells, and she walked across the busy street. So that kind of tells you, I grew up with it, English and dressage and all those things. I I blacked out all the lessons and things like that. But, so you're a hunter jumper. And what gave you the veterinary bug?
That's a good question. I mean, I think both probably a little bit, actually, the horse bug and the veterinary bug. Like I said, my parents were not into either. I had an aunt who she had horses and she had worked as a vet tech. And so like I would spend some time in the summers with her. And I think that's probably a lot of where I got it. And then I've always been a nerd. I'm still a nerd. So I think it was kind of that combination of, you know, like I liked horses and I liked animals. I always did well in science and math. So it was kind of just like a natural fit. But I am that person who, it's funny, a friend who I've been friends with since kindergarten said to me once, she's like, you're the only person I know who what you said you wanted to be in kindergarten is what you actually became. Yeah. She's like, you know, if I had done that, I'd be a professional cheerleader now. And clearly I'm not. But yeah, so I kind of just from the time that I was little said that's what I wanted to do. And it just never wavered.
So what books relax you? What type of books do you read?
What books relax me? I do read a lot. And it varies between, yeah. Let's be honest, if I'm having trouble sleeping, maybe it's reading like a veterinary journal. That's usually pretty good. You bring it on if you're really having trouble sleeping. But in terms of relaxing, it varies everything from like I read both fiction and nonfiction. I get into, you know, like weird little like health kick sorts of nonfictions or some autobiographies. Yeah, I'll kind of read honestly almost anything. Hmm. But I do read every night before I fall asleep.
That is a wonderful practice.
You know, I've had to alter it over time because, like, I still do prefer a real book. But with all of the travel that we do for our jobs, like, lugging around a real book got hard. So then I kind of got, you know, like, where I would just read off my phone. But I'm trying to be better with my sleep hygiene. So I now have gone to the, like, Kindle where it's supposed to be, you know, better with the blue light and whatnot. I don't know what it is. I'm trying.
Yeah. Well, you're putting in the effort, and I think that's huge. I mean, I know I shouldn't be looking at my phone when I lay down, but I do it every night, and it's terrible.
It's hard not to, and so that's the other thing. It's like if I go to the Kindle, I can't be checking my email. I can't, you know, be doom scrolling on the news or whatever else is happening. So that has been my concession to still, like, trying to read, but not. Yep, all night.
My niece and nephew give me the cheesiest gifts for Christmas, and they're just low budget gifts. And you know, if you ever had your phone looking at your phone and you fall asleep and your phone hits you in the face.
Yes.
So he had gotten me like a little thing you can put on your chest that holds your phone. So yeah.
Probably a good investment.
Is it within arm's reach? I kind of want to see it.
Oh no, not right now.
Oh
no,
not really. Later.
No, I'm not using it enough. So you went to A&M. What was that?
Well, that was later.
Later. Okay. We need to, yeah. Between.
You need the whole timeline. So yeah, Penn State undergrad. We are. And then I did University of Pennsylvania for vet school. So I am one of those annoying VMDs. And I'll be honest, like that was very much so. Again, nerd. So Penn State had an honors college. The honors college kind of had this early application program with Penn. So I applied and got in. Like, I never even considered going anywhere else. And I think also, again, growing up close to New Bolton, knowing I wanted to decline medicine, it was like, well, if you get into Penn, you're going to go to Penn. And I got in. So great. I went and never even applied anywhere else. And I give props, and again, super fortunate that it all panned out that way for me. Full disclosure, I still have student loans that potentially had I consider going to an out-of-state school and establishing residency somewhere else, maybe I wouldn't have. But I do not regret my Penn education at all, even though I'm forever stigmatized as a VMD. Then from there, I did an internship at Equine Medical Center of Ocala. And then from there, I did my medicine residency at A&M. So that was my Texas A&M time. From there, I went and practiced in the Washington, Idaho area for a year. And then went to University of Florida, where I was faculty for a little over 6 years. And then from there to industry. Circuitous little route.
So you were all different aspects of being a veterinarian. You were ambulatory, you were surgical. What were all the different?
Yeah, so I've done ambulatory, I've done in-hospital, I've done academia, and now do industry. So I've dabbled in many of the facets of profession. Perhaps I'm fickle. I don't know. But I've liked all portions of it. And honestly, like, I'm glad I've done each of them because they do cultivate very different, you know, skill sets and whatnot.
Yeah.
You have that wide perspective, which is really important.
Yeah. Being a Penn Stater and then going to Aggieland, like, was that a hard transition?
So I was never allowed to call myself an Aggie because to be an Aggie, I was told, you have to renounce your allegiance to any other institution. And I was unwilling.
I'm very proud of you. That is amazing.
Yes. Well, and I actually, it was fun. I forget which year of my residency it was, but one of the years of my residency, Penn State played A&M in the Alamo Bowl.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So that was great because I got to go and I made a whole lot of bets and Penn State won. So that was extra exciting. And, you know, these were the days when Yingling was not widespread. And I had a bunch of friends who drove down from Pennsylvania that we all went to the game together. And so they brought, like, you know, cases of Yingling down. We were a very popular tailgate. Yeah. And Penn State won, and I got to gloat. It was amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah, those Texas people, they really loved their Yingling. That is for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think it was enough of a novelty at that point because it wasn't easily accessible.
Right. And so what did your residency focus on?
So I did my residency in internal medicine, and I'll be honest, partially I went to A&M. So, you know, I always knew I wanted to do internal medicine. You know, I would say kind of one of like the themes of my career is a lot of things didn't necessarily go the way that I thought they were going to, or that I had planned or like had mapped out in my head. So like, I'll back up a second if you want my whole sad little story. So, you know, when I was at Penn, I knew I wanted to do an equine internship. The internship that I was like sure that I was going to get and that I wanted, I didn't get. And I was just, you know, spinning my wheels, kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I was just fortunate that I was on an equine field service rotation with Pete Morrissey at the time. His friends had kind of just started EMCO. So at that point in time, it was a pretty new haul-in practice. And he's like, I think you should go check it out. So I did. I loved it. You know, they became my family, essentially, when I went there for my internship. And so many things in my career stem back to, you know, the year that I spent there. And it was kind of the same. So again, Penn, often people will go back to Penn for their residency. So you might go away for your internship and go back for your residency. That was kind of honestly my plan. Like, I love Pennsylvania. I love the people there. It's great caseload, great medicine. And then when I was an intern, that kind of had some discussions again with some of the folks at EMCO, and they were like, well, you should go check out A&M. And I was like, Texas? Like, what's a Yankee like me gonna do in Texas? Like, again, like hunter jumper. I'm like, I don't know what to do with a quarter horse. Like, okay. But I did go to visit, and I was fortunate for two things. One, the day that I went to visit, Noah Cohen was on clinics. And so I got to spend the day with Noah, and there's no human being I love more on earth than Noah Cohen. So that pretty much swayed me. And then just a couple of things. So at that point in time, internal medicine actually did a lot of the lameness and musculoskeletal imaging at A&M because it was when Kent Carter ran the lameness service. And so it was a little bit kind of that, like, A, just try something different, you know, like, as opposed to, you know, going back where I had already trained, go somewhere that the people and the caseload and the sorts of diseases and whatnot that one might see in Texas would be something I hadn't necessarily been exposed to before. And then even though, like, I knew I wanted to do medicine, I was like, you know, it never hurts to kind of have a slightly broader skill set than I don't want to say just internal medicine, because I don't want to demean anyone that only does internal medicine. But that was kind of part of my interest in going there. And I think it was really good that I did do that, because, like I said, you know, post-residency. So I started my residency in 2006. You know, the equine industry was rolling. You know, it was kind of the great, like, you do this residency and you can name your salary coming out, and you know, there will be so many jobs and blah blah blah. And then obviously 2008 happened. So when I finished my residency in 2009, you know, my plan had kind of always at that point, you know, been to either stay in academia. Like, I had kind of developed a love for teaching, but at that point, you know, nobody had any money, there weren't any universities hiring. So I ended up going into private practice, where I did what I like to say, general practice with a flair for internal medicine.
Nice.
But the fact that I had this background in lameness and musculoskeletal imaging, like, gave me much more, you know, that I could bring to a practice other than just, you know, neonatal foals and sick diarrheas. And I do think it is something. Actually, I was just talking to some folks at the University of Florida yesterday. I was back there for a couple of days. I think as internists, we do so much neurology, like that whole, is it lame or is it neuro? You also come to it with a slightly different lens. If you don't just think of them as neuro, you do also kind of think of the lameness. And so, well, you know, the time that I spent at A&M and kind of that twist on internal medicine training was super beneficial to me.
Yeah.
And just amazing people.
Yep.
Agreed.
What was the most challenging of all of those different things?
I mean, I will be 100% honest, like internships and residencies aren't easy. Yeah. And they're not supposed to be easy, you know, and I think it is something, you know, kind of fast forwarding to, you know, some of what I do now with AAP. So, you know, I chaired the AAP internship subcommittee for the last couple of years. You know, we spent a lot of time kind of talking about like how we can make them better, but I still, even by making them better, I don't want to undervalue what they've always been, which they're going to be hard. You know, it's intensive learning. It should be seen a lot of cases. And really cramming as much experience into, you know, your brain and your hands as you can in a short period of time. So, you know, I think internship and residency were hard. I don't know that I could do either of them again. I think there's a reason in general you do them in your 20s when, you know, you probably are a little bit better at sleeping 2 hours a night and still being able to function. So I'd say just like purely from a exhaustion standpoint, they were both challenging, and studying for boards. I don't know that I could ever do that again either. But again, things that were normal at the time are maybe a challenge now. Hmm. And then again, none of them have been easy. Like they've all been good. You know, so like I said, then I went back to University of Florida and I was faculty there. And I think, you know, being in academia is hard. You know, there's a lot of benefits to academia, right? Like one of the things that I loved most about it is you're surrounded by a lot of really smart people. And so it's always easy to, you know, go down the hall and find someone that can be like, hey, can I bounce this case off you? Or, you know, you've been doing this a lot longer than I am. You know, do you mind coming and kind of giving your thoughts? But in academia, especially kind of the historical model of academia, you know, you're trying to balance, you know, you're on clinic seeing cases, you're teaching students both in the clinic as well as in the classroom. You know, there's generally a research component, there's an administrative component. So, you know, I think from a time management standpoint, academia was very challenging, just to kind of balance all of those different roles, which I think everything in equine or in veterinary medicine, right, is trying to figure out how to balance whatever your roles and responsibilities are at any point in time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And it made me think of something when you were talking about that. And I feel like for like new grads that are getting out of school, they were probably in that similar scenario, right? They're used to being surrounded by experts when they were in school, and then they could ask questions and stuff. And then they get out on their own and they're kind of like, oh man, it's just me. Like no one's coming. It's up to me. Right. Like expect the self-rescue. So how would you advise someone in that position to get along, like when they feel all alone, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's definitely something that we know is part of the hurdle to keeping young veterinarians in equine practice, is that dichotomy between in a small animal practice, you know, you probably are in a brick and mortar where there is someone in the room next to you versus equine practice. You can feel very isolated. And so I think a couple of things, you know, one, by no means do I think that every person has to do an equine internship, but I do think there is a lot of value, again, to seeing a whole bunch of cases and kind of building that network of, you know, kind of your own experts, you know, that hopefully are mentoring you in your internship, that you can then, A, in that year, get comfortable with some things and then be able to lean back on those people. Again, if you can find a practice that will equally provide that mentorship in an associate position, great. I think it's just hopefully a little bit more kind of organized mentorship in an internship experience. Whether you do that or not, I think we're all learning, right? Like even now, I'm going to see a case that I've never seen before and I've been in, you know, out for 20 years. So I think not being afraid to say, I don't know. And I think it's easier to say that probably the older you get. I think when you are a young veterinarian, like you feel more intimidated saying that to an owner. But I'll be honest, I have never had an owner that got mad at me for saying, I don't know, assuming that I followed it up with, I'm going to talk to some other people, or let me go like check on something, read something, do whatever, get back to you. I think people respect that. And so I think for, you know, our young veterinarians, I can tell you again, as a former faculty member, I still have veterinarians that were my students 15 years ago that call me for case consultations. And I love that. Like, I'm happy to do that. So, you know, wherever you went to school, wherever you did, if you did do an internship, continue to reach out to those people. It is a lot of what we do. And we all want to mentor our young veterinarians because we want to keep them around. So I think, you know, if you're staring at a case, like, never feel bad saying to that owner, let me talk to a couple other people and get back to you. And we'll all learn from that. And I think most owners are fine with that. And then again, you build your own experience that way.
Yeah. So as an industry person, you do consult with a lot of general vet practitioners. Yep. Honestly, where do you see the most deficiencies? You know, like a human doctor doesn't learn enough about nutrition. What areas are you seeing deficiencies?
That's a good question. And I think it varies a little bit. I think, you know, the types of caseload seen at different schools might dictate that a little bit. You know, like, there are some schools that, just based upon either the faculty that are there or just, again, the types of cases that they see because of regional variability, again, some of them might see a ton of neurology and other ones don't. So some of it might be a little bit where you're trained. I think we're all very guilty, myself included, of kind of like self-fulfilling prophecy too, in terms of like whatever you're interested in, you probably kind of pay the most attention, you know, kind of like read up on, pay attention to those things. And so like it's kind of easy to have holes in maybe the things that just aren't naturally as interesting to you. I mean, I think to your point, Ryan, most veterinarians are not good with nutrition either. I think it's just one of those, probably across all medical disciplines, maybe that gets a little bit left out of the curriculum. But I think a lot of it is kind of just whatever isn't maybe your favorite thing is easy to feel a little bit deficient on.
So would you recommend, obviously, besides going to the AAP website to get answers on recommendations for things, that's one place to go that I know of vets that do. Should veterinarians just be reaching out to the industry, depending on what product they're using?
Yeah, I think there are so many resources, right? I think definitely, especially if it is much more of like a product specific question, like absolutely reach out to whoever the manufacturer is of that. You know, I think we all have, you know, veterinarians that work for all of the different companies, you know, that are going to be experts in those exact things. And especially, obviously, you know, wearing my pharmacovigilance hat, you know, if it's an adverse event at all, or, you know, a lack of perceived efficacy, then honestly, like, you need to talk to the manufacturer of that product, because we have an obligation to report that to the FDA. But in general, especially that if it's product, vaccine, whatever, like, we're going to be the experts in our own things. So definitely any veterinarian that ever has questions about any of our specific products can reach out. And I think it is important, though, like, that doesn't have to be a problem. I think sometimes some veterinarians do think like, oh, I'm only supposed to call, you know, Boehringer Ingelheim if I had a problem with one of their products. It doesn't have to be that. It can also just be a different use of it, an off-label use. The, hey, do you know anything about this in foals? You know, I see that the label says, you know, that it's not for, you know, pregnant mares. Do you have experience on that? You know, it can be those sorts of questions, or kind of more case workup, you know, case management type things too. So I think absolutely reaching out to, you know, industry veterinarians, in addition to, like I said, you know, any of your previous educators, I think we'll all tell you kind of what our interests are and what, you know, we're kind of comfortable consulting on.
This is kind of a newer topic, is where you should be charging clients for telemedicine and things like that. So for a veterinarian trying to get a consult from another veterinarian who is busy in their own world, if they don't necessarily have that network, are we kind of encouraging veterinarians just to be more open to collaborating and making themselves available and taking a couple extra minutes to mentor and help?
No,
is there an opportunity there?
Yeah. And it's where it's such a hard answer, because I agree. Like, it's funny, actually, I was having this exact conversation with someone earlier. Like, we're not great about charging for consults, and we never have been. And I'd say internal medicine, we're probably like the worst about that, because so much of like internal medicine can be done on a consultation basis. Open the phone, you send me a chemistry, you send me an image from a gastroscopy. Like, Like, it's pretty easy for me to talk about that versus, you know, a surgeon talking you through colic surgery is probably going to be, you know, a little bit of a different situation. So I do think we haven't always been great about charging for that. And part of the challenge with that, honestly, is that, like, if I am in private practice, like, yeah, I probably should be charging you more for that time, or you should be sending me those cases. So again, like, if you're a general practitioner, you have questions about a bunch of cases, if a certain percentage of those result in you referring that case to that practice so that they are then generating income, then maybe it does work out more in the wash. That being said, we also, you know, run into those that, like, are constantly calling for help and never refer cases. And if you are in private practice, you're now losing money by taking all of those calls. Where that gets complicated is, like, you know, looking at myself in the mirror right now, you know, as both people in academia and people in the industry, we're usually not charging you for those consults because it is kind of part of our, you know, obligation, our duty, you know, as a provider. So then it makes it harder for our colleagues in private practice to charge because people kind of figure out. So I don't have a good answer to that. I think, you know, I guess I would say, like, my plea to general practitioners is, again, like, always call us, you know, if you feel like you want to. If you are, let's say, again, you have a really good referral clinic that you do call a lot, make sure that you're not only calling them for help, but you're also sending cases, because that is ultimately how they get paid. Until we work out a better system to actually charge for telemedicine.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's coming. It's going to be, might be flying cars before that, but
it's going to happen. I
think people aren't getting it. You know, and it's funny, like, even with it being part of my job and industry, like, I will freely admit, like, I do a lot of consults for, you know, people who I've met through my role in Boehringer Ingelheim that call me for things that have nothing to do with our products. They just know I'm an internal medicine specialist. And so they're like, hey, I've talked to you about these things before. Can I ask you about X, Y, or Z? And the number of them that now at the end of that conversation are like, can I pay you? Like I will pass this, you know, cost along to this horse owner, but, like, I do want to pay you for your time. And I'm like, well, I'm not always set up to do that. Like, so I think, like, there is increasing recognition that we should be doing that, definitely pass that along to the animal owner.
Yeah, because when I'm riding the shuttle to the airport, that driver, you know, they're doing a great job. You want to support them. You don't have cash in your pocket. There was one genius that had a Venmo QR code up there. And, man, I'm sure he had a much happier life, was getting paid a lot more tips.
It's like you go to a bar anymore and, like, bands have, you know, a little scannable cue to tip the band at the bar so that if you don't have.
My favorite one is when I'm driving down the highway and someone, like, put it on the back of their car. They're like, just married. And they have, like, a Venmo handle on there for you to, like, give them money. Have you ever seen that? That's wild.
But that gives me ideas. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, that's one of the reasons to have a wedding.
Yeah.
Or gift.
Money.
Put the QR code on the back of my car.
Yeah. Weddings are funny. You can't just ask for straight cash, but boy, is it nice. Yeah.
QR code takes all the awkwardness out of it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, go ahead, John.
No, I wanted to take a step. I wanted to step back to your journey, right? Because we haven't completed that full circle yet. So I am extremely curious. I think you're the first AEP president that's going to be from industry, right?
So Tom Lenz.
Oh, Tom Lenz. That's right. And I know Tom Lenz on a personal level.
Of
wonderful
course.
Man. Okay. So is it, well, I'm really interested to know how you got to that, right? Like, how you wound up as the AEP president elect. But also, like, is that controversial with some folks? And how do you navigate that?
That is a mighty fine question. Let's see, kind of my path to AAP leadership. Actually, I was just telling a couple of students this the other day. So I was the vice president of my student AAP chapter when I was in med school. And I was an AVMA delegate too. So, like, I've kind of always, for whatever reason, kind of been involved in organized veterinary medicine. And I'm very much one of those people, like, I don't like to just complain about something without feeling like I'm trying to do something about it. And I've just been fortunate to be in roles where, like, I've kind of had the bandwidth to be able to maybe do that and to feel like I could help. So it started way back when I was a student. And then I kind of had various roles kind of throughout my career. When I was faculty back at University of Florida, I was the faculty advisor for the student AAP chapter. I did some stuff with ACVIM, but really, I think AAP is where I found my people. And again, like to our conversation, like it's such a equine world is so small anyway, but like AAP is just a fantastic organization. Like they've always treated me well. I feel like they do good work. And so I had gotten involved with a variety of kind of different committees within AAP. So I was on educational program committee. Like I said, I was the faculty advisor. I did membership engagement committee. So I'd kind of done a few things there. And then, you know, I will freely admit, right or wrong, a lot of the path to AAP leadership is a little bit your network and who you know. And I was very fortunate that so I mentioned earlier when I was at EMCO, Rob Franklin was the internist there at the time, obviously a past AAP president. And then when I was at University of Florida, I worked with Margo McPherson, also an AAP past president. So, you know, I was fortunate to have the two of them kind of in my corner, you know, that when it kind of became time to, you know, nominate people for board positions and whatnot, I ended up on that list. So then I was on the AAP board, and that's kind of the pathway. So at this point in time, from a board standpoint, essentially there are 7 board members. Anybody older may remember they used to be district based, so it was kind of by geography, and I forget what year we kind of got rid of that. So now there's just 7, and it doesn't matter where you live, but get voted in. So I was on the board, and was fortunate to really be on the board when all of this sustainability stuff kind of came to light. You know, it was when we realized that we were having problems with retention and recruitment, and really kind of had a concerted effort to put some of these subcommittees and whatnot together to really dive into it. So while I was on the board and kind of at the tail end of my board service, was when some of this was coming to light. And so myself and Jackie Christikos, who's at Littleton, you know, kind of took on the role of the internship subcommittee. And so that was kind of our little baby to work on. And I think for the most part, then, like the path to being an officer is that you were on the board and generally had some sort of project, some sort of like something that kind of proved some of like your leadership skills in an area. And so I think a lot of it for me was kind of proving my worth, so to speak, you know, by chairing that subcommittee, and then was, you know, fortunate to end up in the, you know, vice president role, and then president-elect, and then president next year. So that's kind of like the path to how I got there. And again, so much of it was just, you know, good support from, you know, people who had gone before me. To your question, so yeah, essentially I'll be, you know, number 7 in terms of women that will have been president, and then essentially number 2 from industry.
Tiny clap, jazz hands.
Thank you. And I will be 100% honest, like, We actually joke, we had an AP officer call last night, and Eric Mueller even said, he's like, I'm actually going to get you different, because I will say many times in many situations, like right now I'm wearing my barrier hat, or right now I'm wearing my AP hat. And it is like, it is a balance that I think like there is some concern. I can't dismiss that from others about kind of, you know, potential conflict of interest or, you know, influence, you know, with me kind of still being active, you know, within Behringer from an employment standpoint, and then being in this role. And so I kind of just try and own it, really, and just be like, hey, like, and I think that, you know, the flip side of that is I have been in all of these different roles between academia, private practice, and industry, that like that has given me some skill set and some knowledge that is helpful, you know, in this role, even just in terms of things like some of, you know, the manufacturing issues and, you know, FDA things that I didn't know before I worked in industry, in terms of, you know, some of the like what you should and shouldn't say, you know, when the FDA or USDA is involved, that, you know, I can now bring a little bit more kind of awareness to AAP. So it's, I think, kind of looking at the good of it there. And again, first to say, like, if it comes to, you know, voting on things like educational partners, whatever, you know, I recuse myself at that point in time and kind of say, you know, like, I recognize as the employee of, you know, one manufacturer that I will step out of this conversation now. And so far, I think it's worked. And I mean, I have told all of the other officers as well as AAP staff, like, if there's ever a conflict that I haven't recognized as a conflict, please tell me. Like, yeah. You will not hurt my feelings if you say, like, is there, I think this might be a conflict of interest. You know, you should probably, you know, step out of the conversation. And
so, yeah.
That's what the AAP membership feels like.
Yeah. And I'm sure they will. And I mean, I feel like your transparency obviously leads to the genuineness of your level of ethics. And you, like you say, being an open book, and you're a tremendous communicator, and anybody that knows you, you know, you're somebody that people want to be around. But also, like, your history of what you've done with the organization, right? Like, you're a veterinarian first. You obviously want to contribute. You're someone who sees issues and wants to help solve them, and not just be someone who complains about them. Like, all those things obviously should put people at ease. I mean, I know it does for me, for sure. Yeah.
Turn haters into motivators.
Yeah.
Yep. Backing up, so your path to becoming president-elect, is there sort of a norm or unspoken rule about how this works? So you have to be on the board, and then you have to be the secretary. What's next? So it's board, ascendancy to the throne. Let's talk about it. Yeah.
And it has changed just within the past several months. We just had a bylaw change. But pretty much, like, the main criteria is obviously you have to be an AAP member to, you know, be an officer. But really the continued criteria is, and I think always will be, you have to have served on the board. And so board service is a 3-year term. I think, again, just to understand really how AAP governance works, how the different committee structure works, you know, kind of have put in the time and again, kind of, you know, proven your commitment, for lack of a better term, by being on the board. And then from there, how it works is that, so there's an AAP nominating committee, which has both some board members on it, some past presidents, and some members at large, that they go through every year and, you know, look at people who have fulfilled that board service that are interested in, you know, carrying on and becoming an officer. And then they make recommendations from there in terms of who to move forward. In the past, really until this current year, you know, that nominating committee essentially, you know, made the recommendation for who that vice president was going to be, and then it would be ratified by the board. We just did a bylaws revision so that now the nominating committee will come up with two names, and the general membership will vote for who actually becomes the vice president. And so then the succession from there is essentially it's a 4-year term, but your first year, you're vice president, your second year, you're president elect, third year, you're president, fourth year is immediate past president.
What do you feel like you guys were trying to accomplish by basically making that more democratic by having two candidates?
It's really just by making it more democratic.
Oh, okay.
Feedback, you know, from members, just that they, you know, wanted to feel kind of more included in that process. You know, so to get on the board, I should back up a step. So to get on the board is a similar kind of, so again, generally to get on the board, you have served on, you know, several committees and kind of done some other things for AAP. Nominating committee also puts together those board ballots. But the nominating committee there, depending upon how many positions are open in a year, you know, come up with 4 or 6 names, and the membership votes on those. And so there kind of been this, like, well, we get to vote on who's on the board, shouldn't we also get to vote for who the officers are? And I think, you know, there was some discussion about it, and you know, I can kind of see all sides of it. But yeah, essentially, you know, we want the members to feel like they are being represented by who they want to be represented by. Yeah. You know, again, we are a membership driven organization. So that is where that came from.
Yeah.
I have a silly question. For the nominators, is it kind of like always a bridesmaid, never a bride? How do they get nominated? or are they just not interested in ascending?
It's a few different roles, and it's a good question, because actually I was on the nominating committee when I was on the board. So obviously, yeah, you can't nominate yourself. So like when you're on the nominating committee, you are excluded from becoming an officer. But like I said, there are people on there who have already been officers. So there's, you know, I think 2 past presidents on there now. But if you are on the board, then you kind of say, like, I won't be eligible for these roles for these, you know, 2 to 3 years that I'm on the committee. And then there's, you know, members at large as well. So it's, you know, you're not on the nominating committee forever. Like I said, it's a 2 to 3 year, you know, term that you're essentially excluded from then, you know, self-nominating.
You know, being president-elect, tell us how many hours a week you're working right now.
Deep pause.
I know. Good question. I would say on average, between both convention programming as well as just other officer duties, kind of, you know, keeping tabs on everything that is happening, you know, within the industry, within various committees and whatnot. It varies a little bit from week to week, but I would say probably on average-ish, like 10-ish hours maybe a week. Some weeks more than others. So especially like when we were doing, putting together the program and, you know, really getting all of the session facilitators lined up and kind of their speakers and stuff lined up. It's a little bit more than, you know, then you kind of like go through a lull and then the papers come in and it's reviewed. So it does kind of ebb and flow some. But just baseline level of, again, kind of emails and committee calls and whatnot, it's bare minimum of, you know, several hours a week. And I think it is one of the things I will, again, you know, fully disclose, like, I'm fortunate, right? So it would, I can see why it is a challenge for someone in private practice that is still an, you know, busy ambulatory clinician out in the field. It would be challenging. I would love to have to continue to see people in that role, in these roles. But from a time management standpoint, you know, I think there is always this, you know, perception of, you know, a lot of the officers having previously been retirement age. Some of that is, again, just the time management, really, to be able to do it. I can kind of see why it flexed to that demographic just for having the bandwidth at their stage of life to be able to do it. And there has been a very concerted effort over the last few years to shift the officer population to, you know, people who are still, you know, actively working, whether that's in, obviously in my case, industry or academia or practice. But it does make it a little bit more challenging just from a time management standpoint.
In my organization, I always say it's my cross to bear because I play polo cross and it's the American Polo Cross Association. And as early as like 17 years old, I was on the board. And so I served my time and then I took probably a 10-year break and then I got back on the board. And, you know, there's not enough volunteers. So it's kind of a thankless job. And, but you have your seasons. And so at some point you say, okay, I've served my time. Let's let someone else come in and take over. And so you're kind of at the crescendo, right? I mean, because there is a constant influx of new blood, right, that's coming through.
And I'd say, as opposed to your polo cross organization, like AAP has too many people. I shouldn't say too many. So many people who want to volunteer. Like, yeah. Like it's a luxury of riches, really, in terms of like every year we have way more people that want to volunteer in some capacity than we have places to put them. So it is good that way where it's not like you feel like you have to do it because no one else will. Like we are very, very fortunate that way that it is more the like, yeah, we need to find ways to create more opportunity for people to volunteer or make sure that we aren't just recycling the same people, which again, is something we've fully been accused of in the past. And I can't disagree. Like, I think I'm a product of that. Again, you know, I said how many different things I've been involved with. But we are really consciously trying to make effort to involve more of our younger members or members that haven't previously been picked to serve on committees and have volunteered year after year after year, that we really do want to include those people because we don't want to function in a vacuum. You know, we want those different voices. We want people to feel invested and included. You know, I think we also recognize we think this is true of everything, right? Like this is true in like your personal and your professional relationship. Like we think we're communicating, but we're not. And so we hear that a lot too, that people just don't know what's happening or, you know, we include it, you know, a call for volunteers for something. People are like, oh, well, I never saw that. I didn't know that that was happening. And so we're trying to figure out ways to do that better. Like we recognize for some people, email isn't the right answer. You know, are there ways via social media or other things that we can make sure that we are actually telling everyone about both the opportunities to volunteer as well as the output of all of those committees? Because they're all doing amazing work. You know, like how can we make sure that everybody knows everything that's happening? And we're working on it. Like, we know that the website is still a problem. Like, there's, you know, efforts continually going into making that better. And, you know, the thing that I just always tell people is just, like, assume positive intent. You know, like none of us are getting paid for this. Like, this is all 100% volunteer. Like, we're all trying to do the best that we can. Like, if you don't know about something that happened or you missed a call for volunteers, it's not because we were actively like trying to hide it under the rug. It really is just we thought that we had communicated it and somehow we missed the mark and we're sorry for that. But reach out to, again, any of the staff, any of the various volunteers, because we do want people to feel included and feel like their voices matter, and that we want, you know, to spread what we are doing with them. We just haven't always figured out the right way to do it.
Yeah. Well, on a positive note, it's like pretty amazing about what it says about our industry that many people want to contribute, what it says about the culture of AEP, what it says about the culture of the equine family, that many people want to contribute, that it's almost hard to find a place for everybody. Yeah.
No, it is. We're super, super fortunate that, yeah, so many people want to do something. And yeah, it is just finding places to fit all of them. And, you know, I think we've been trying to also get away from the, like, you know, blinder classic that we all have, which is like, to be involved is that you have a 3-year term on a committee. Like, maybe that doesn't work for you. Again, like, maybe you just want to volunteer for one, you know, small project, a little task force, hosting one certain event, going to university and, you know, talking to vet students. Like, we're trying to really broaden the spectrum of what involvement looks like, that it doesn't have to be like so regimented that it's off-putting or not doable for, you know, again, especially, you know, someone maybe newer in practice or that has young family or has aging parents, you know, that like the time commitment is too much for a very standardized thing, but you still have ton to offer. You know, how can we make sure that we're, you know, incorporating those people as well?
Yeah. How do you balance all these people wanting to help and making decisions? Because there's times when you want to lead and you think, you know, you're making the decision, you're helping make that decision. And then there's times when you want input, and obviously you want input along the way, but is there some bureaucracy slowing you down with all the different things going on?
I guess a little. I don't even want to say bureaucracy, because that makes it sound negative. I think sometimes we are slower because we try and kind of go through this like channel hierarchy, which I suppose by definition maybe then is bureaucracy. yeah, we try and have a lot of things, again, kind of be mostly at that committee level. So again, if it's, you know, something involving racehorses, like the racing committee, you know, they're going to kind of talk about it. So if that's a position statement or whatever it might be, like, let it start with them. Like, they hopefully are the subject matter experts, you know, if they are on that racing committee, or they know who the subject matter experts are that they should reach out to. So it kind of starts at the committee level. And then from there, generally goes to a board vote. And then, you know, either again becomes an approved statement or whatever it might be. So it does slow down a little bit because, again, everybody's busy. So even to get committees together to work on things, depending upon the depth of whatever that project is, you know, can be challenging just to get, you know, to get 5 equine veterinarians that all have the same time open on their calendar, obviously can sometimes be a bit of a challenge. So trying to go through that step does sometimes slow things down. But again, like, our committees are amazing. And I think anytime that it's been something that's been a little bit more urgent, so it is a new disease or, you know, something like that, or something that we really feel like there's a time crunch on, we're usually pretty good. And especially with now having Zoom and, you know, the ability to do more things virtually versus, you know, the days where everything had to be done at a couple of in-person meetings. You know, the technology that we have today certainly, you know, can help. You know, I think from the bigger kind of crowdsourcing, you know, the AP listserv has been fraught with issues over the years in terms of sometimes kind of going off the rails with people not always behaving super professionally kind to each other. But we do still get good information from there. And so, again, we're working on figuring out what other ways are there for us to communicate. You know, we know, right or wrong, Facebook is still a primary means for a lot of people to feel like they can kind of communicate and case share and whatnot. So we're continuing to kind of play with some of those different technologies, too.
I have a question from sort of 30,000 foot level. what is the purpose of AAP, or what do you see as the mission? But from another perspective, when the AAP is being successful, what is it? What does that look like? What's happening?
Yeah, so I mean, really, in terms of like the overall AAP mission, it really is to, you know, support and better the equine veterinary profession and those who care for the horse. So, you know, we have a strategic plan for AAP that we essentially kind of reboot every, you know, 3 to 4 years. So we will do a strategic planning session again this year. But we kind of have like 3 buckets that we kind of think of within AAP that the bulk of our efforts go into. So one is going to be education. You know, convention has always and will always be kind of our flagship event. But we are doing lots of other educational events now too. We recognize people want more, you know, small wet lab, hands-on type events. So we have started the XP series to do those. And so, you know, there will always be a big educational component of AAP. You know, kind of our other bucket is the profession. And so that's maybe more of a nebulous bucket. But that's where a lot of, again, the sustainability stuff certainly fits in there. So recruitment, retention, you know, how can we keep equine veterinarians in equine practice? Ethics are going to fall within there. You know, some of the advocacy things. So, you know, we hear a lot about whether it's, you know, lay dentists. Obviously here in Colorado, it's the mid-level practitioner. You know, a lot of those, full disclosure, are things that AAP doesn't have control over. But can we at least help you with resources specific to your state to deal with whatever? A lot of these are more kind of state issues. They're not necessarily things that we can help, but we recognize our member concerns. So that kind of fits within the profession. And then the horse. Obviously, none of us would be here if it wasn't for the horse and our love for the actual horse itself. And so, again, that's where, like, you know, kind of the hot button term now, obviously, is going to be, you know, social license to operate. And so that is something that, you know, we recognize is going to become big for our industry going forward. You know, obviously before it was everybody, you know, kind of focusing on racehorses and the racing industry as, you know, kind of the, you know, poster child for, you know, is it okay how we treat these animals? And, you know, it's everybody now. So it is, you know, not just a focus on racehorses, but between various things, you know, associated with the Olympics and some other things or carriage horses in New York. So again, AAP always wants to be looked at as the expert resource for the horse and what is appropriate for health and welfare and well-being of the horse itself. So I think those are at least kind of the 3 buckets that AAP continues to focus on and will continue to focus on.
Covers a lot of things.
It does. That's a big old piece of pie there. Yeah. Lot to take on. I was really curious to ask you about what, I mean, we're very aware of what's kind of happening right now in the industry, right? And the retention recruitment piece. I feel like we're kind of in this transformation period right now. I'm not exactly sure what it's going to look like on the other side, but because of this very issue, like the industry is transforming. So I was really curious to get your impression, like, and we all know the issues, so you don't have to state all of those, but what does it look like to you? And then what do you think it looks like in the future?
I mean, I'm probably biased, but I do feel like we're making progress. And I think it's a lot of things. I mean, I think it is just that recognition that just because we've always done it one way, that's not going to keep working. You know, just right or wrong, generationally, you know, the younger generation has kind of said, like, we want more work-life balance. You know, we're going to have better boundaries. We want to share caseload and share emergency coverage more. And so, you know, I think that's all good and healthy, honestly. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think some of the like pushback to some of that, and I will really put myself in this own category, is like, as someone who didn't always have those boundaries, sometimes like, well, darn, like you're doing better at this than I am. Like, that's yeah, not fair, but good for you. And I think like there is now more recognition of like, we're all just going to have to do better. And kind of that rising tide raises all ships, right? Like, I think some of the practices that maybe, you know, almost felt like forced to go to a 4-day work week or forced to, you know, have different emergency coverage. Now, even, you know, the more established, you know, associates and owners in that practice are like, yeah, that's actually pretty good. Like, I like having a 4-day work week too. And it hasn't affected our bottom line. We actually are making more money. We are more efficient. And so I think it is just some of that like push to change. Once some of us could get past some of our own roadblocks on it, like we're seeing the benefits to it in all of us. And so I think just being open to some of those creative ways to do that, I think is just getting more apparent. So again, whether that's emergency only practices or like I said, you know, co-ops or just, you know, sharing coverage. I think a lot of that is becoming more acceptable and more palatable to people. And so, I think, and as we do that, hopefully we will both keep those younger practitioners as well as, you know, woo students into that. Because, I mean, I think students right now, I think the message has been changing. I think students for so long were told like, you know, I was told this 20 some years ago, like, don't go into equine if you ever want to ride your own horse. Like if you want to actually have a horse, do small animal and have your own horse on the side. And I think we just now have enough representation of people who are like, no, like you can do it all. It's not always going to be easy. It's not always going to be comfortable. It might vary season to season, right? Like maybe you don't have much of a life from February to June, depending upon where you are and what your practice type is. But great, you can take some time off, you know, in the fall and summer and kind of do things there. So I think it's just being open to creativity and being open to change. And I think more people, whether they wanted to be forced into change or not, are recognizing that that is the way to go. And I think, again, as our younger, you know, students and young associates see that, they will stick with it and continue to expand that creativity, because a lot of them are the ones coming in with some of these ideas or just the willingness to kind of do things a little bit differently.
Yeah. It's an interesting story, and it's happened over and over again in time. And the it's like the trendsetters and the younger people come in and they transform the industry.
Yeah.
Is a generational gap being just sorted out by the aging population, boomers selling practices off? Because our whole last podcast was about bridging the generational gap.
Yeah.
So is that a focus from AAP? Do they talk about that a lot?
We do. And it's one of the things that's hard too. But like we also, like we don't want to make it a us versus them, like generational warfare sort of thing. And honestly, like some of our older generation are like super open to a lot of these things. Sometimes it's actually like, again, I'll put myself in the, like the Gen X category that are sometimes the most rigid and hard to change. So it, you can't even really like put it into buckets. I think it is just all of us being able to have conversations, and again, what works for one person, one practice, one area might not work everywhere, but let's just be open to having that dialogue about the why. You know, like I'm proposing that we go to a 4-day work week. I've pulled out the numbers, like here's what it is, you know, and this is why I want to do it. Or again, you know, I think we could make it that we turn off our, you know, on-call coverage at 11 p.m. because we've pulled the numbers and less than 10% of our emergency calls actually come in between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. and that's burning people out. Like, I think, you know, the more that we can kind of look at data points and have conversations around that to maybe remove a little bit of the emotion and a little bit of the us versus them that otherwise starts, then I think we're able to do that.
The other day, I met a veterinarian at a dinner meeting, and her job is just pure emergency call that she takes for other veterinarians. You know, it's an issue out there in the industry, boundaries, burnout, having to take call. If you don't have four other vets you're working with to share call, it's a tough thing. And so I think that is that's a trend setting type initiative, and she's been very successful. And so I think it's putting those things out there and talking about, you know, just putting them on a pedestal and just saying, here's some great ideas. And if you want to, you know, and just encouraging more people to do things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. To be creative. Well, and it's obviously like emergency only has worked on small animal for a lot of times or for a long time for slightly different reasons, just because of the way that they're set up. But yeah, like we do hear from more and more veterinarians that, again, just because of, again, like family situation, like they have kids, one parent works, you know, kind of a traditional 8-to-5. So just from a childcare standpoint, maybe working emergency is perfect for you because now your spouse is home for the childcare and you can do the emergency. You know, like I think there are, you know, there's always been this like perception of like who would and wouldn't want to do certain things. And it's like, no, like, to your point, just put it all out on the table and be like, hey, what are some ways that we can make this work? And I think we're constantly hearing of stories of people. It's like, oh, that's kind of a cool solution.
So bear with me on my analogy here, but I'm not trying to be political, but and I know that's going to scare you just saying that, but no, minimum wage hasn't gone up since 2009. It's like $7 federal minimum wage. And if you adjusted it to inflation, it would be about $23, $24. It'd be a lot. And so where do you think equine veterinarians' annual income should be had they increased their prices properly over time? You know, we hear numbers like you come out of school, you're making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. I know it pays what you can pay it, but where should it be?
Well, and that's a hard question to answer. Like, I can't give you a number because obviously there's also just cost of living differences. And like, there's so many differences to that. And just that reflection of like, how hard do you want to work, right? Like, maybe you're comfortable with making slightly less money and working, you know, less hours or not pushing yourself as hard versus somebody else. So I can't give you an exact number. I mean, I think if we look at compensation as a whole, like it has definitely improved. And some of that is our understanding of an ability to analyze that. And so when we go back to the, Commission on Sustainability, one of the other subcommittees was the compensation subcommittee. And partially that subcommittee kind of got together because there was feelings and recognition that some of the numbers that AVMA was putting out probably weren't super accurate and were going to be off-putting to students or to young vets who'd be like, well, if I could make this, you know, this is what AVMA is saying, I could make it small and equine, why would I ever do equine? And so as we've gotten those numbers, salaries have gotten better, I think, A, more accurate, and B, are increasing. And so, I mean, I think they will continue to go up. If we look at least kind of in that first 10-ish years, the averages are still going to be lower than small. I can't lie about that fact right now, but I think the compensation subcommittee, which has now been rolled into the finance committee, is continuing to look at that. And from a trend standpoint, does seem when you get 10 years and past, equine often you can be making more than you could in small animal. And I think what'll be interesting, or at least our feeling on this, is especially when we look at the increase in, you know, corporate ownership of small animal practices, like, yes, some of those are offering some huge signing bonuses, you know, some numbers that coming right out of school look amazing, but kind of just plateau. Like, there's really not a whole lot of opportunity above that versus in equine practice, you know, especially if you can and have any interest in becoming a practice owner, it's like the sky's the limit. Or even, you know, just with production based, you know, that there is much more opportunity to continue to increase, you know, your take home compensation in equine than there might be in, you know, some other facets of the profession.
You know, we really did not intend to just rattle you with really tough questions, but
we did.
I hope you don't feel that way.
Not at all. What I get paid the big bucks for.
Yeah.
She never
sweats. And by big bucks, I mean zero.
she never sweats. Thanks for sending this last question I had up for you. John, you've really, this is not going to sound good asking this question after you said that, John. Okay.
Now I'm nervous.
Okay. So let's say you had $1 billion, okay.
With a B, just to be clear.
First $10 million on chili, right? You had to put it into one part of the equine veterinary industry to help project it into the future, into a positive way. If you could just put money into one thing, a ton of cash to promote one thing, what would that be? And from my knowledge, it might be, you know, incentivizing more students, you know, giving them more income. It would, you know, or it would be, maybe it's marketing, I don't know. But yeah, so what would you do with that money?
I think, so I've had this idea before, I just don't have the money for it. What I think could be very helpful would be, it would take a lot of money, but essentially have like a centralized teaching and research herd and farm. So if we essentially had a place that, you know, could host all of these various wet labs, but would be very, you know, easily usable to bring in veterinary students, you know, recent graduates, and really be able to do a lot of hands-on training there to get them confident, to increase their skill set, which would increase their marketability and their profit, you know, if they can be doing things, you know, earlier on, and kind of more efficiently in their careers. I think that that would benefit the profession overall and would just alleviate some of the, and again, don't get me wrong, like, there's a million people doing a lot of wet labs right now, you know, ourselves included, but just having a very centralized, easy place to work with to do that. So you're not kind of having to like recreate the wheel all the time, or figure out like what you can do with, you know, certain animals and whatnot. And like I said, even if I had really all of the money in the world, like I said, that same group, you know, essentially having a herd of research animals as well, because I think, you know, there is such limitations, you know, with doing equine research with large enough numbers, and control groups and all of those sorts of things to really have good, you know, results from a lot of those studies. So we're limited by that, and it's only going to get worse, you know, just as, you know, cost of keeping research animals keeps going up. You know, it's getting harder and harder for a lot of universities to even maintain their teaching and research animals. That again, if we could have that in a way that, you know, we felt very good about the care of those animals and all those sorts of things from a, you know, a welfare and well-being standpoint, but could easily bring people together for kind of some of those teaching opportunities. That would be my little baby.
Where would it be?
I mean, I feel like Lexington is the easy answer.
Yeah.
Just because AAP headquarters and whatnot there, it's kind of a cool place to go.
So not a bad place to visit either.
Okay. So if you're listening out there, this, we need to make this happen. 10 years from now, it'll be called the Dr. Sarah Roos Institute of Equine Veterinary
Learning. Research.
Yeah. We have to think about a good acronym. Yeah. John could do the natural horsemanship. Now he could buck out a horse to break it, but he also does the natural horsemanship stuff. He can do it.
You're hired.
John.
And Ryan just get.
He's, no, he's been to Australia, mate. He's worked with some of the best horsemen in the world.
That's true.
And he knows how to handle a horse. He hasn't done it in a while, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I got to hold a horse today.
Okay.
And that horse, he was amazing. I didn't have to do anything. He was like super cool. But yeah. Held a horse for like an hour today in a clinic. So, you know, small. Yeah, still got it. Yeah. No.
So basically the whole idea of this would be to fill in some gaps that maybe not every university can handle. And
especially obviously with the increasing amount of like the distributive model schools, again, having a place that would be easy to essentially send their students for, you know, horse boot camp. So some of it would even just be the basic handling stuff, you know, how to put a halter on, how to pick up a foot, like how to do a physical exam, like an easy place for all of the different universities to have access to some ways to do that kind of throughout their curriculum, but then to continue to build on that with much, much more technical skills as we get, you know, into later years.
I used to work at Harvard Polo. So the whole idea that you would have never had to handle a horse, but you could still be Harvard Polo player, and those poor horses, they're so stoic. But yeah, bringing people that don't have horse backgrounds into the industry. Tufts University has a program that I heard about the other day where they get to sign up for time with horses throughout the day, and that 20 minutes or so that they spend might get them hooked. And even
when I think
vet school,
well, because there has always been this perception that like you can't be a horse vet unless you grew up with horses. And that's so not true. Like some of our like most illustrious, you know, members of our profession did not grow up with horses. But like there is still kind of that stigma. And so yeah, like the earlier that we can break that by getting people comfortable with them, because I get that there is a little bit of a fear and intimidation factor if you've never been around horses and, you know, now you have this like, you know, 1,500-pound flopping colic, like that is a little scary. I don't dismiss that. But I don't want people to feel like you can only do equine practice if you've been around a horse since you were a toddler. Like you can absolutely have not touched a horse until you are in vet school and still be a phenomenal equine veterinarian. And so the more ways that we can expose people to that, the better.
That would be cool. I'm in on this. Yeah.
All right, let's start fundraising.
Okay.
And any listeners with a few cool $1 million that you're looking for?
No, it's a billion. It's
foundation.
We'll make it happen.
Well, we can just have a Venmo handle, see what happens.
Put it on the back here.
I mean, otherwise, we're just going to be sending drones out to look at horses and fix horses. It's going to be crazy in the future if we don't, you know, if we don't continue to make more.
Growing our profession.
Yeah.
Right.
So next year as president, you're going to be doing a lot of international travel. So what are all the different conferences again that you're going to?
There's a few. So the first one for the year is WEVA. So that's the World Equine Veterinary Association. So they have a meeting generally every 2 to 3 years, depending upon kind of where it's at. It'll be in Bangkok, Thailand. Mm, cool. So that will be interesting. It's going to be at the Jockey Club there, which I think will be fascinating. So excited about that one. Not excited about the plane ride there, but excited about, let's see, where else? So the president generally attends the Mexican equine practitioner meeting. So that'll be somewhere in Mexico. It kind of rotates location. There's the, what is it, FEVA? So the Federation for Equine, or for European Equine Veterinary Associations. So that'll be somewhere in mainland Europe. BEVA, so the British Equine Veterinary Association. And then Bain Fallon, which is the Australian equine practitioner mm-hmm. meeting, are kind of the main ones that we go to. And, you know, I've already had an opportunity to interact with, you know, various leadership from several of those organizations. But I think, you know, in talking to, you know, the presidents above me, so, you know, Tracy Turner, Katie Garrett, Rob Franklin, and on up, is just that the challenges are the same. Like, so much of what all of these meetings turn into is talking about, again, the recruitment, the retention, the social license to operate, you know, the use of horse in sport. So I think it is really beneficial for us to not operate in a silo and see, again, what other, you know, solutions and, you know, ideas have other countries and other regions come up with to deal with some of these issues, because we're all facing them.
Hmm. Wow. Well, that's some optimism. And some hope. You'll have a lot of fun on those trips, and you'll represent us well. But that's all I have. Do you have anything else, John?
No. This has been a real pleasure. And I mean, I just can't believe we're sitting here with you, and we're just a garage band, you know? Like, this is awesome. Yeah.
Well, we're
so thank you.
Always happy to try and get the good word of AAP out there. And again, I know sometimes people get frustrated, but we really are trying. We recognize the needs of the industry, and that, you know, I think, like, we know that still 50 to 60% of our members are 1 in 2 doctor practices. And I fully hear that a lot of times they kind of feel underrepresented because so many of the positions are those of us who are in different states. And we recognize, like, that we don't want to forget about those members. You know, we hear you, we see you, young members, old members, whoever you are, like, you're all important, and you're all horse vets, and that's what we're here for.
Well, the AAP is obviously in good hands. You're going to be an amazing steward, and I'm excited for your
ascendancy.
Spot. Yeah. Ascendancy. Tenure. Yeah. Tenure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to
be
good.
Yep. That's all we have. Thanks for your time. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you both as well.
We will see you out there in the industry soon.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. It was good to see you.
You too.
You guys have a good weekend.
All right. Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so you and I are obviously biased because we knew Sarah before we had this call.
Yeah, shocker. But, yeah, spoiler alert, everybody.
Yeah, but she's so fun.
Yes.
Easy to talk to.
Yes. Approachable.
And she can be very direct. I mean, she's so genuine.
Yep.
Very, very comfortable in her own skin. And I just appreciate all those things about her. Yeah, that was good. I definitely tried to hit her with some hard questions, but she handled them all really well.
Of course. Yeah. And I think that's also part of being able to ask those questions, having the confidence in someone's, you know, personality and their level of thinking that they're going to be able to handle those things. And yeah, I mean, she's great. So, and a superior communicator, by the way. Yeah. And I really appreciate that about her.
Yeah, because it's one thing to be a super genius nerd.
Right.
It's another thing to be like a cool, understandable, super genius nerd.
Right.
Yeah, it's the best of both worlds. So
I agree.
Well, cheers to you, Dr. Roos.
Yeah.
We're very lucky, Dr. Roos, to have you on here.
Very lucky.
Do you have feedback? Community is the primary mission of the podcast. Do you have a comment or suggestion from an episode? For an opportunity to be featured, please record your feedback on our website's feedback sidebar button. You can record up to 5 minutes. For more about Velio Mentis, go to veliomentis.com. Find us on Facebook and Instagram. If you want to support this project, please click on the Patreon link in the show notes. If you enjoyed, please subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you.